Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that very kind introduction. It's truly an honor and a privilege to be here. And I should point out, this is the first talk that I've given under this rubric. So I'm especially nervous that this comes off well. So let me give you a quick indication of where we're headed. My purpose here is to give you a snapshot of the methods of direct detection of extrasolar planets using imaging. And because planets are very faint compared to their host stars, this is high contrast. And just to put things into perspective, by high contrast, I mean achieving contrast ratios between the star and the planet. Ultimately, we'd like to get to contrast ratios of a billion to one. And I'll describe an experiment that's underway at the Gemini Observatory to achieve a contrast ratio about one-tenth of that, or 100 million to one. And so along the way, I'll describe some of the science reasons why it's worth achieving these contrast ratios to detect extrasolar planets, some of the difficulties, and then towards the end, some of what the future holds. So let me do a very quick motivational slide here that explains why this is worthwhile. We'd like to know how abundant planets are. We'd like to know, for example, if our own solar system, despite the fact that we know that we've already detected about 400 extrasolar planets, we'd like to know if our own solar system is somewhat typical. And then there's this question that I dismiss frequently as this tiny little parochial question: are terrestrial planets common? Because maybe that's an interesting place to look for biosignatures in the universe. We don't have a great deal of information yet about what types of stars host exoplanets, simply because the current methods, principally the Doppler method, is only sensitive to a narrow range of masses. And then, of course, there's physics of planets, how do planets form? The study of planet formation is a little bit like cosmology 20 or 30 years ago. We don't know if planets form top up, top down, or bottom up. We don't know what the principal pathways are for forming planets. And then there are other interesting physical questions associated with their interiors, for example, equation of state questions. And then the last frontier of what astronomers would call stellar atmospheres resides in planet atmospheres between those of the temperature of Jupiter, which has an effective temperature of about 125 Kelvin, and the coolest objects that we know from the other end of that range, about 600 Kelvin. So there's a vast unexplored range. So if you're into weather, this is the place to look for new physics. So for the past roughly 15 years, the Doppler technique, which is an indirect technique that looks at the radial velocity of the host star, has been extraordinarily effective at finding extrasolar planets. So we've gone from a situation where we didn't know whether planets were common or not to our knowledge now that we know that many, many stars have companion planets. This is a great technique, but the information is the radial velocity of the star. It doesn't tell you anything about the physical properties of the planet itself, except the mass, which modulated by an unknown factor, the inclination of the orbit. The Doppler technique also has a very specific bias. It depends on Kepler's third law, that is the relation between semi-major axis and period. And that means if you look at the discovery histogram of extrasolar planets found by the Doppler method, the exploration of orbital phase space, this is semi-major axis separation in astronomical units, one here is the Earth-Sun distance. There is a peak, this is an apparent peak just due to selection bias, about two astronomical units. And this is simply because the searches have only been going on for about 15 years. Jupiter-type planets are starting to be represented in this histogram in this bin at about five astronomical units. But our knowledge of the outer solar system, which in our own case hosts planets like Saturn all the way out to Neptune. The periods here are way too long for these to have been represented in the Doppler searches. So not even Berkeley graduate students can see Saturn complete its orbital period. And of course, you have to have a full cycle, at least one cycle. So out of 30 astronomical units, which is probably close to the edge of the original solar planet-forming disk, we have no chance of understanding the population with Doppler methods, and we have to turn to direct imaging as one of the principal methods to survey these outer regions. So just to summarize, these Doppler methods only yield a subset of orbital parameters. They give you the period directly. They don't give you mass of the planet. They give you the mass times the sine of the inclination, and the mass of the planet only comes out if you know the mass of the star. You need to know the ratio. You only get the ratio. In some cases, there are mutual eclipses because the orbit is nearly edge on, and that gives you a lot more information. And a great deal of progress has been made in eclipsing system right now with NASA's Kepler mission. So the conclusion of this first section is when you turn to Sky and Telescope or Scientific American and you see pictures like this, well, you know, this is just the artistic impression. And what we do want to is get beyond this. Perhaps Carl Sagan's vision of the solar system is something we'd like to have. This is the Voyager 1 image taken on Valentine's Day in 1990, looking, in a sense, back over its shoulder about 6 billion kilometers away from Earth and recording images of, you can see a very overexposed picture of the sun here, and in here is Earth and Venus and Jupiter all the way out to Neptune. We can't do this for any solar system yet except our own. But this would be the ultimate goal, to be able to see the family of planets in extrasolar systems. To give you a sense of the magnitude of the problem, we can look at an example where you can blot out the sun's light and see planets during the day. So this is the eclipse of August 30th, 2008. This is a photograph from Mongolia. You can see the sun is in total eclipse. And if you had a better projector, you could see here's Mercury and here's Venus. And so by removing the starlight, you can start to see planets. Here's actually a much nicer picture. It shows Venus. It's about 2 billion times fainter than the sun. And because the moon's there eclipsing the sun, you can see it during daylight. This also lets you see directly the sense of the problem. Let's see. These background stars you can see. Now, these background stars are at least a factor of 10 to the 5 further away than the sun. So imagine Mercury, in this case, orbiting one of those stars. It's 10 to the 5 times closer and a factor of 10 to the 5 squared or 10 to the 10 times dimmer. So finding Mercury orbiting one of these stars is obviously very difficult. So how do we achieve those contrasts? And that's what I'm trying to get to in the next stage. Okay. As an interlude and a fanciful picture, this photograph from National Geographic somewhat illustrates the 100 microwatt, give or take a factor of few, firefly next to the couple of 100 kilowatt searchlight. The brightness ratio is approaching 1 billion to 1. Okay, what can we do right now? There are some facilities that can achieve contrast ratios at large angular separations, many arcseconds, approaching 1 billion to 1. One of them was this advanced camera that was installed in the Hubble Space Telescope early this decade in 2002. This facility has a coronagraph that allows you to suppress the light from the host star. And in a program that's been going on for over a decade, my colleague Paul Callison at Berkeley imaged this star. This is Alpha Piscis Astrinus, the mouth of the whale. This is an interesting star because it hosts what's known as a planetary debris disk, a cloud of dust in a disk that's orbiting the star, known from the infrared emission from this star. If you point the advanced camera on the Hubble telescope at Fomalhaut, which is its Arabic name, you see this. Not very good prospect for finding planets. But if you repeat the experiment by looking at a different star, in this case Vega, and you difference the two images, this is what appears. And maybe this would be a time to kill the lights. So you can see artifacts at the center of this image where the star is. That's this dark region. But you can also see the scattered light from the debris disk. So this ring of dust is scattered light from the star. You notice a couple of things, and this was immediately apparent in 2004 when these data were first obtained, is that the location of the star is offset from the center of the ring. That means there are gravitational forces acting on these dust particles as they orbit. And the resultant paper that we wrote speculated that this geometry was a consequence of a planet orbiting interior to this belt. And when we returned to this source in 2006 and took second epoch observations, we discovered that the source that's shown in this box is actually moving on a trajectory that's parallel to the belt. And between 2004 and 2006, this object, which is about a billion times fainter than Fomalhaut itself, is moving on a Keplerian orbit. The estimate of the mass of that object from how it shepherds the dust grains in that belt is about somewhere between half and two Jupiter masses. So there are that's one example of a directly imaged system with the Hubble Space Telescope. And towards the end, I'll show you some examples that are beginning to be obtained with ground-based telescopes. So let me say something about science motivation. I already mentioned some of these questions, like planet formation, but a simple one is a statistical one. Given what we know about the semi-major axis distribution of planets from Doppler studies, there's as many planets between the region of orbital phase space surveyed by the Doppler techniques and the outer regions that are surveyed by direct imaging. So we can improve those statistics by at least doubling the number of planets. By seeing out to regions like Neptune, we can discover whether our own solar system is a common one. And we can see within these planet-forming disks regions where we have good reason to believe that planets may form. For example, in our own solar system, out beyond about 5 astronomical units, is where ices condense. And that provides more solid material to build planets. And you may expect to see a large increase in the number of planets beyond that zone in these disks. And so if we can reach out there, we can probably find those planets. The Fomalhaut result itself poses questions about the relationship between planetary debris that we already know about. The surface area of the dust that scatters light in this image is much larger than the surface area of the planet. It's much easier to see these debris disks. If we understood the relationship between the planets and the debris disks, we could learn a lot more about the planet formation process. So how would you go about detecting these? In the case of Fomalhaut, the light that we detect at visible wavelengths is almost certainly reflected starlight. In general, does it make sense to look for this reflected signal? The answer is no. We know enough about Doppler planets to put them on a chart like this. It shows contrast, assuming an albedo, and angular separation because we know the semi-major axis of the orbit and we know the distance to the star. And if you look at the contrast ratios and the angular separation, the median here is a few tens of milliarc seconds. So that's a couple of times the diffraction limit of an 8 or 10 meter telescope in the near infrared. And the contrast is very low. This is about 2 times 10 to the minus 8. So a typical, fairly low-tech coronagraph may work out at angular separation about 3 times the observing wavelength divided by the telescope diameter, which on an 8-meter telescope is just a little bit more than 100 milliarc seconds. So seeing the reflected light from Doppler planets is not an option. And of course, if you remember from that first histogram, these planets are very close to their host stars. As the planet gets further away from its host star, there's a 1 over r squared dimming. And so for planets in the outer solar systems, these are undetectable using reflected starlight. So reflected starlight is not going to help us explore outer solar systems. However, as in the case of Jupiter, which still has some heat of formation, young planets are luminous. Here's a time scale running from a million years to 10 billion years. So the typical time scale for formation for Jupiter mass planets is probably a few million years. So there's some interesting history that's not represented in these simple cooling polytropic models. And from that epoch to the current age of the solar system, the evolution, the thermal history, is fairly straightforward. So at least to first order, you can estimate how bright or how luminous a young Jovian mass planet would be. So this tells you that the contrast, this is in solar luminosity, so in our, on this scale, the sun, a one solar mass star, is up here. A one Jupiter mass object takes a trajectory along here. So at a few hundred million years, the fractional contrast is about 10 to the minus 7. And it's actually better than that because these objects are not black bodies. Let's look at, we'll come back to that in a second. In fact, this is probably in the wrong order. I want to look at this one first. These are some spectra of cool objects. These are very cool stars. This is one of the coolest known so-called T-dwarf. At 700 Kelvin, the chemical equilibrium favors the formation of methane, and the atmosphere shows these very strong methane absorption bands. Same thing as well as ammonia seen in the atmosphere of Jupiter. So these objects are not black bodies. And by taking this information and extrapolating it for what you expect, objects in between 700 Kelvin, the coolest T-dwarfs and the hottest planet that we know about, we expect there to be significant emission at near-infrared wavelengths that will render these planets detectable. So here's an evolutionary sequence of different colors. This is in spectra, wavelength, contrast ratio. So in the visible, where these objects only shine by reflected light, the contrast is hovering at about 10 to the minus 9. But in these bands, where the opacity is much lower, and you see deep into the hot interior of the planet, there's very non-black body-like behavior, and contrast ratios of approaching 10 to the minus 7 is possible for young objects. So this is the fingerprint that you can hope to go after in young planets that will allow you to achieve detections at relatively modest contrast ratios of 10 to the minus 7 instead of 10 to the minus 8. So here's two orders of magnitude that help us out. And then I want to go back to that. And maybe almost, this is a very astronomer-esque type of diagram showing the evolution of planets as a function of time. Here's effective temperature, which is essentially a proxy for the surface flux coming out of the planetary atmosphere. And this is the surface gravity at the location where that photosphere is. So in the room right here, the temperature is about 300 Kelvin. The gravity is 9.8 centimeters per second, meters per second per second. So we're around about here. Jupiter right now lives over here, 125 Kelvin. Surface gravity in quotes, this means at the photosphere, about four times greater than the Earth. And the trajectory of a cooling Jupiter runs along this red line. These other lines are for more massive objects. So here's 20 Jupiter masses, here's 10 Jupiter masses, here's half the Jupiter mass. And this is a diagram where you can think about how to populate different types of atmospheres. For example, these methane-dominated cool dwarfs live up here. We have Jupiter here, and no objects known to us in this location in the middle. So this is complete terra incognita in terms of what we might expect to find if we were able to detect these young objects. Okay. So how do you achieve contrast ratios exceeding 10 to the minus 7? Well, there are some problems, and let me go over those. And the first one is very simply diffraction. That is, and maybe you should kill the lights again for a second. If I have a perfect telescope, that is no wavefront errors with a circular pupil, the diffraction pattern is an airy pattern. The first airy ring is about 4%. And so on this linear scale where the core is saturated, this doesn't look terribly bad. But these airy rings are relatively bright out to large angular separations. So if you look at it on a plot like this, here's one at the center, and in this scale, this is going out to one arc second, you can count airy rings. And the decline of the diffraction pattern is very slow. It's a one over angular separation cubed. So to get to angular separations of 10 to the minus 8, you have to go to large angular separations. And because the planets we're interested in are nearby stars, we're interested in looking at, in this domain, in a few tenths of an arc second. So even if we had a perfect telescope, the diffraction renders detection impossible in this domain. What you really like to have is something like a Gaussian point spread function, which declines much, much faster. And that, of course, is not possible to produce, but there are ways to approximate this. You can see this is a simple consequence of Fourier optics. That is, the smoothness of the pupil function, that is, the transmission across the telescope pupil, the smoothness of that function determines the compactness of the point spread function. And there's a nice theorem which allows you to compute how quickly the brightness of the point spread function decreases with radius as a function of the continuousness of the function. And so this cartoon illustrates that. So if I have a telescope transmission function that's a simple top hat, then the point spread function, this is the electric field, goes as 1 over the angular separation. So it goes as 1 over angle squared in intensity. That's because this function is discontinuous. Okay, if I make a telescope pupil that's a convolution of two of these top hats, so I now have a continuous function, but its first derivative is discontinuous, the electric field goes as 1 as the angular separation squared, and so the intensity goes as 1 over angular separation to the fourth power. And as I make this function smoother and smoother by convolving together more and more of these top hat functions so that I now have a first derivative that's continuous, I get more and more compact point spread functions. And so I need to turn my telescope pupil from something like this to something like this. And this, of course, is a very well-known problem in electrical engineering, which is how to remove side lobes, either in the temporal domain, in signal processing, or in the spatial domain when I'm designing an antenna. So I don't want that, which of course everybody's telescope looks like that, because the disadvantage of this is that it transmits less light than this telescope. And since most astronomers are interested in collecting as much light as possible, this is not favored, even though this is what you want for planet detection. So there is a vast, intriguing, and wonderful literature under this topic of apodization. They generally come under the rubric of coronagraphs in honor of Bernard Leo, who built the first high-contrast astronomical imaging telescope to look at the solar corona. That's where the name comes from. And there are many different ways of removing the side lobes from diffraction. There's no, in essence, no general theory of how to do this, which is why there's this proliferation of different techniques. And I will not even attempt to describe these different experimental approaches that you can use to essentially go from this type of pupil function to this one. Needless to say, there's lots of alternatives. Each one would have different advantages and disadvantages. So the other problem, now that we know that the nature of the problem with diffraction, is our telescopes aren't perfect. There are wavefront errors, and these wavefront errors come from two places. They come from the atmosphere itself, because the Earth's atmosphere is turbulent. There are temperature fluctuations, and the refractive index fluctuates along the line of sight, and so phase errors accumulate as a wavefront propagates through the Earth's atmosphere. And an initially plain wavefront reaches the telescope and is corrugated. So the pattern on the bottom of the swimming pool is something of an analogy for this, although this is obviously a case of very extreme wavefront errors where there are caustic crossings that produce these patterns of light and dark on the bottom of the pool. But essentially, the problem is the same. How do you quantify the shape of the surface that causes the wavefront errors and correct them? So over the last 15 years in the astronomy world, and in the last maybe 30 years in the defense world, there have been various projects to combine wavefront sensing, wavefront control to implement solutions that correct wavefront errors. And this is generally referred to as adaptive optics. There are two principal hardware components in such a system that corrects incoming wavefront errors caused by the atmosphere, a wavefront sensor. There are lots of different ways of measuring the shape of wavefronts. And the second part is a deformable mirror, which is simply a mirror in which I can push on the back and cause spatial variations in the phase that match the error in the wavefront that's coming in. And so these parts are actually really quite simple and straightforward. The intelligent part of the system is the mysterious gray box here that's labeled real-time computer. And this is where all the calculations need to be done that take the measurements in an optimal way to control the mirror. And so this is the hard bit, because not only does this estimation need to be done with precision, it needs to be done on a time scale over which these wavefront errors change, and the atmosphere is blowing past at meters per second, and the turbulence size scale is small, and so the coherence time for these phase variations is rather fast. And so this closed loop control needs to have bandwidths of the order of kilohertz for this to be effective. So the consequences of not controlling and controlling atmospheric wavefront errors are shown in this picture. On the left is some data from the 3-meter telescope at Lick Observatory with an AO system that's turned off. You can see when the pattern freezes at the end, there is a accumulation of speckles, which is essentially the diffraction caused by that random phase errors. Each one of these is associated with a coherent cell in the atmosphere. And when you measure that wavefront and correct it, the light is concentrated in a small spot. So this is part of the way to solving the problem, but the contrast ratio, this is shown on a linear scale that's achieved with this simple adaptive optic system, really doesn't give you the magnitude of the problem we need to deal with. There are a second set of errors associated with our problem. That is, we have atmosphere, which is a fluctuating part, and there are also imperfections in the telescope and all the optics that follow the telescope that give you a static or quasi-static aberration pattern. Now, the problem is that the diffraction from those quasi-static wavefront errors will look just like astronomical sources, and I can demonstrate that in the following movie. So this is a movie of Vega taken from a 4-meter telescope on Haleakala in Hawaii, equipped with a very high order AO system. This is produces a very near diffraction limited image, and the contrast ratio is now such that the region out here is about a part in 10 to the 5. So these spots are about 1 part in 10 to the 5 of Vega itself, and all these little dots here are artifacts. They're not planets in Vega system. So controlling these and eliminating them is the principal difficulty with the current generation of adaptive optic system. There simply is not sufficient precision of control in these existing adaptive optic systems to be able to eliminate these speckles. Okay. So to turn the current generation of adaptive optic system into something that's usable to detect planets, I need to give you some sense of of scale. Very roughly, the contrast that you need to achieve is proportional to the variance of wavefront errors. And so in a plot that shows contrast contours, so here is 10 to the minus 9, so this is Mercury orbiting the sun, or actually very close to Jupiter. A contrast ratio of 10 to the minus 9 is along this contour. And the axes here are telescope size and the wavefront error. So this is the static wavefront error in your system. And this is in nanometers. So 1 nanometer RMS wavefront error on a 10-meter telescope gives you a contrast ratio of about 10 to the minus 8. Now, if you look at what you might think of as state-of-the-art, here's the Hubble Space Telescope. It has static errors of a few tens of nanometers, and this was one of the finest pieces of optics ever produced for astronomical purposes. So you can see that we're many, many orders of magnitude away of achieving this 10 to the minus 9 contrast on the Hubble Space Telescope. And only by pushing down on this axis in wavefront errors can we get to our goal of seeing these self-luminous planets, which is somewhere about this 10 to the minus 8 contrast, which means getting to a few nanometers RMS. You notice that the contrast is a strong function of telescope diameter. So probably the best place to do these experiments right now is on the ground on large telescopes. And this is also a very strong motivation for building even bigger telescopes as large as 30 meters, such as the TMT telescope. Okay, so let me put together a recipe for achieving high contrast to find extrasolar planets. So you need precise and accurate wavefront control. Okay, so it's got to be precise at the nanometer level. It's got to be also accurate at the nanometer level. Otherwise, you'll have an image full of speckles that look like planets. You need to do this very quickly because the atmosphere is flying past it at meters per second. And you need to do it on a sufficiently fine spatial scale to capture the spatial variations in atmospheric turbulence. So on an 8-meter telescope, you need about 1,000 degrees of freedom on the mirror that you use to control wavefront errors. And you need to do this many thousand times per second. I've talked all about phase errors. There are also amplitude errors, which are particularly pernicious. And I'm not going to have time to say very much about this. So the second point was the one I addressed first, was talking about diffraction. You need to be able to remove the side lobes in diffraction. And this entire system needs to be stable so that if you do have speckles, then the speckles are sufficiently static that they can be removed by some kind of differential imaging, either by locating yourself on a telescope where the sidereal field rotates, and so an altazimuth telescope with a fixed Cassegrain focus is ideal. And you can also use the spectral information in the speckles, since they're chromatic phenomena. They're produced by diffraction. Their behavior in the spectral domain is significant. Okay, so let me give you a sense of an experiment that combines those factors. So an adaptive optic system, this is a measure of seeing, typical of good sites like Mauna Kea or the Chilean coastal sites, an AO system running at 2.5 kilohertz that samples the atmosphere on 13 centimeter separation. And if the system has an ideal coronagraph, then you can record planets in this domain. This is angular separation. This is contrast. So each step here, this is 5 magnitudes, is a factor of 100. And this is the contrast achieved. Each little dot here is a simulated star hosting a planet. And down here, these large contrast ratios, there is the domain of Doppler planets. And each one that could be detected by a Doppler survey is circled. And then the ones that lie above this contrast threshold of this ideal system are labeled with squares. And so this type of calculation helps you figure out how, amongst all the different types of coronagraph and all the different performance issues of the adaptive optics system, how to identify a scientifically useful experiment. One of those things, it shows you, for example, where these planets lie in semi-major axis separation and planetary mass. Pretty much all the planets that were labeled on this previous diagram fall to the left here. At small separations, the directly imaged planets are over here at large separations. So direct imaging does, in fact, find, has a potential to find, a completely different sample of objects from those that we know about already. And in particular, returning to this effective temperature surface gravity plot, this type of adaptive optics system can find planets that traverse this terra incognita in between the coolest known T-dwarfs that are up here and the hottest planet in our own solar system. So these are objects that will typically have temperatures, say, between 400 and 200 Kelvin, and are particularly interesting because, for example, they cross this line in the temperature gravity space where water clouds condense, and that's those are clouds that have not been seen previously in planets, either in our own solar system or in other astronomical objects. So what I'm going to do is show you some details of the specific instruments that's been built for. This is the Gemini South Telescope. It's a 8-meter telescope in the Chilean coastal mountains. The instrument for this telescope is the highest order AO system that's currently being built for an astronomical system. It has 1,800 actuators. It's going to achieve near diffraction limit at 1.6 microns. The part of the recipe in addition to this AO system is that all the optics have extremely high precision, meaning 2 to 4 nanometer errors on their surfaces, and it has an advanced coronagraph selected from that complex topology that showed the map of coronagraph land. And the back end of this adaptive optics system is an instrument that records both the spectral information and the polarization state of the light. And the combination of recording the spectrum and the polarization state of the light helps to distinguish between astronomical signals and speckles. It's a big group of people across 7 major institutions. Actually, one more. The lead project management and PI is at Livermore with Bruce McIntosh. Locally, we have René Doyon at University of Montreal, and not so far away, Ben Oppenheimer at the American Museum of Natural History. Also in Canada, at the Hertzberg Institute, systems engineering, the optomechanical construction and software, and some of the other components, including probably the most important innovation in this AO system is an interferometric wavefront sensor that I'll describe in a moment, being built by Kent Wallace. And let me show you some of the details of that instrument. It's a modest-sized instrument. It weighs about a kilogram. It's a 1 meter cube, goes at the back end of the Gemini 8-meter telescope. The instrument is conceptually simple. In practice, it's a little bit more difficult, but it comprises several major subsystems, a coronagraph, which is essentially a series of masks that control the amplitude of the electric field that's transmitted. So there's an apodizer that apodizes the pupil function in the sense that I already showed, that has a radial transmission gradient. And there's a second optical component that's very simple. It's just a mirror with a hole in it. So the light from the star actually goes through this hole, and the planet light, if the adaptive optics system is working correctly, gets reflected off this mirror. The wavefronts are controlled in two ways, and they begin with wavefront sensing. There's a conventional Shack-Hartmann wavefront sensor, which is a wavefront sensor that divides the pupil into sub-apertures and records the wavefront slope across the pupil. And then there's this interferometer that's an absolute measure of the wavefront accuracy at this location. And then the light that emerges from the interferometer goes to the science instrument, which is this spectrograph here. So there are some details in practical implementation of the coronagraph, because if we go back two slides, you notice that the Gemini telescope is a conventional astronomical telescope that's axisymmetric. There's a hole in the center of the primary mirror, and light is directed from the primary to the secondary mirror through a hole. And so the pupil of the Gemini telescope is not filled. There's this nasty black spot in the middle. And that causes a great deal of problem for coronagraph design. And so there's apodization of the pupil both on the outside and the inside. Despite that fact, this combination of a apodizer and a pinhole that rejects the starlight gives us performance better than a classical LEO coronagraph by about two orders of magnitude. The principal technological aspect of this instrument, or innovation that makes this instrument possible, are MEMS devices that are used to control the wavefront. This is a deformable mirror that's implemented in silicon, so using the same photolithography techniques that are used to develop integrated circuits, you can build a 64 by 64 element mirror. So on pitch of about 400 microns inside this, you can control the surface profile at rates of about 5 kilohertz. So it's devices like this that make this instrument possible. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the principal innovation in wavefront sensing here is this interferometer. It's essentially a Mach-Zehnder interferometer that uses the light. So the science light comes through here, goes through a pinhole. So this is a rejected starlight and ends up at a beam splitter here. The reflected light comes off the front side, is combined, is separated at an 80-20 beam splitter and goes back and interferes with the starlight that wasn't rejected. And so we can measure wavefronts here at this spot, which is exactly where you want to control the wavefront. So even though you accumulate wavefront errors from the telescope on down, the final delivered wavefront at the coronagraph spot is the place that we're most interested in the wavefront quality. And the interferograms formed here tell us exactly how this is performing. This interferometer has a demonstrated precision now of a fraction of a nanometer and is going to be the secret to having this instrument working. We have lots of optics in hand. The optics are polished by the same manufacturer who's making the mirrors for the James Webb Space Telescope. Although these optics are much smaller. This is an example of a I'm not supposed to say it in inches, but it's a 4-inch optic with about 4 nanometer RMS wavefront error. So these are working extremely well. The integral field spectrograph is fairly conventional. It uses a microlens to deliver micropupils onto a grating and produces a spectrum for every pixel in the field of view. And over the last 6 months, the initial construction of the optical bench has been taking place at the Hertzberg Institute. This optical bench gets delivered to Santa Cruz in October, and test and integration of the different components happens through the end of this year and through early March, and we'll be on the sky discovering planets in June 2011. And I'm going to wrap up because I see my time is almost up. The last couple of years have been extraordinarily exciting for direct detection of planets. We published the direct detection of the Fomalhaut planet already. Seems like a long time ago. This was in 2008. That same year, Christo Marois published images using the Gemini telescope of the HR8799, not just one planet, but three systems. And of course, our own Ray Jarodana discovered this object in Upper SCO that's also a planetary mass object. And then earlier this year, the Betabik planet, which was announced in late 2009 from archival data obtained in 2006, reappeared. So this is the star Beta Pictoris is behind a coronagraph spot. This was the candidate reported in 2009. Betapix discoplanetary debris runs like this. And then in late 2009, that object reappeared the other side of the coronagraph spot. So we now have one, two, three, four very reliable planetary systems that have been imaged. And it's the promise of this instrument, the Gemini Planet Imager, to increase that by two orders of magnitude over the next 5 years. That, of course, is not the end. When I look at this picture, I think, you know, this is a century of development in telescopes, from the 5 meter Hale telescope, which was built starting in the late 1930s, saw first light about 1948. Hopefully, TMT will be operating before 2040. There is a huge advantage to having large telescope apertures for direct detection of extrasolar planets. And specifically, the combination of this large aperture, large collecting area, will allow you to go to even earlier stages in the evolution of planetary systems. So the Gemini Planet Imager will see planetary systems. The 30-meter telescope will allow you to see planetary systems forming. So with that, I will cede the floor back to Sabina. Thank you.